principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Professor Anne Firar Scott teaches history at Duke University. She's a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, where she's writing about women's voluntary associations in 19th century America. Dr. Scott was educated at the University of Georgia, Northwestern University, and at Radcliffe College, where she received a doctorate in 1958. Professor Scott has written books about the feminist social reformer Jane Addams, about Southern women, and about women in American politics, religion, and education. She's contributed articles to numerous scholarly and professional journals. Dr. Scott has held fellowships from the American Association of University Women and the National Endowment for the Humanities. In your writing, you have stated that women have traditionally been viewed, or see themselves, under one of three headings: the feminists, on the one hand, the anti-feminists on the other, those who feel that that feminism is a threat to a secure and assigned role in the home. And the third category is those who are just indifferent. And yet you say that those categories are inaccurate. Why is that?
As you know, Wayne, of course, I was talking principally about the 19th century, although I'm not sure that it wouldn't apply to the 20th. I tend to live in the 19th. I think that what I have discovered over the years is that the 19th century women do not fall into such tidy feminist, anti-feminist, and indifferent categories so much as they distribute themselves along a wide spectrum, going all the way from the extreme women's rights people, who were a very small number, always a very small number, on the one hand, to the people who, for example, took a very firm stand against women's suffrage on the other. But in the work that I've done with groups like, let's say, the Women's Missionary Societies, a very traditional group, normally, you think of, or the Women's Christian Temperance Union, I find a very large measure of feminist sentiment. Even though the women continue to live in a very traditional manner, even though they continue to define themselves as home-loving Christian mothers. And so I've come to the conclusion that you have to say that almost every woman in the 19th century was not in a tidy box, but was somewhere moving along a spectrum in the direction of becoming a feminist. Yes, I would say even the anti-feminists, the ones who joined the anti-suffrage societies, were behaving like feminists, as is often the case today.
How do these three interplay with one another? Obviously, they're not necessarily exclusive.
That's right. And people change over their lifetime. This is what I'm suggesting, that they change as they grow older. I think that the extreme feminists, the people who announced to the world that they were in favor of women's rights in 1848, let's say, were a small handful of, for some reason or other, very courageous people who didn't mind being laughed at, could take it when the newspapers provided cartoons showing them to be very, very peculiar kinds of people, who didn't mind being accused of being unnatural women and all that sort of thing. Among the group of women that were very traditional, very well behaved, who continued to behave like ladies, you find many who are discontented with some aspect or other of the role assigned to women. But they also constantly, I think, felt that they could only get along in the world by behaving properly. You have a kind of tension there between discontent on the one hand and proper behavior on the other.
They're fighting the system, living within the system.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right. And they fight it in very in ways. They fight it best in groups that are made up only of women. When they have to confront a world that includes men, they become very ladylike.
Are these the rebels? Or is that too harsh a word to
use? Well, sometimes they are, and sometimes they are becoming rebels, and sometimes a particular event will make them a rebel. I remember, for example, a woman who had worked very hard for many, many years to help her husband build up a farm in the Middle West, and it became a successful farm. He died, and he willed the entire farm to his children by first marriage. This woman became a feminist overnight. She joined the Women's Rights Association. She began to write letters to the editor. That experience had convinced her that there was an injustice in the law, and that until that injustice was removed from the law, people like herself were going to suffer.
How did you conclude that there is such a social continuum?
This notion gradually emerged in my head after years and years of reading personal documents. There are all kinds of historians, as you know. You associate with all kinds of historians at the Humanities Center all the time. And for certain kinds of history, people spend a great deal of time with what you might call public documents. A social historian, such as I am, and a historian of women in particular, looks to a different kind of document. Women have not left, by and large, a very large public record, but they have left an enormous private record in the shape of personal letters, diaries, speeches that they have made in women's groups, poems, short stories, a raft of material of that sort. And I started reading this kind of thing in the mid-50s. And about sometime in 1976, let's just pick a nice date, it suddenly dawned on me that what I was seeing was latent feminism in all kinds of shapes and sizes.
Well, your remarks indicate at least the advantage of not having to stereotype people, not pigeonholing them. But on the other hand, this gives rise to a lot of confusion, doesn't it?
Oh, it makes it very hard. And if you are the kind of person who thinks that a neat category is necessary in order to have neat thoughts, you better stay out of women's history. Because women, for one thing, do lead a double life. They have to. The society forces lots of people, or did, perhaps even still does, forces lots of people to behave in one way in public and another way in private, one way when they're mixing and mingling with men and another way when they're only talking to women. And this leads to confusion. You're absolutely right. And it leads to lots of misunderstanding on the part of my contemporaries, and the younger historians in particular, have not got much tolerance for what they consider to be hypocrisy.
Professor Scott, you state, I believe, that feminism is a value.
Yes.
How is that?
Well, it's a value. What is a value? A value is what you think really matters. And I suppose that we all have values, things that we think are truly important in life. And for a feminist, equality of opportunity and the opportunity to be treated as a human being first and a woman second is a value.
Professor Scott, how do shifts in values occur, particularly with regard to feminism, if feminism
now
is indeed a value?
If you and I could answer that question, Wayne, we would immediately be elevated to the top rank of our profession, because I think that one of the truly puzzling things in social history or in the history of thought is the mechanism by which values shift. Just today, before I came to talk to you, I'd been spending all my time reading religious material from the 19th century. And I realized that for a person in 1980 to fully appreciate and understand the pervasiveness of religious feelings in the early part of the 19th century is an act of enormous imagination. Now, what happened? Somewhere between, I would say probably 1880 and now, 100 years, a whole range of things have simply dropped out of our culture. I don't mean that we don't have religion anymore. We do. Obviously, in some ways, the church and religious life is extremely important right now in our society. But it's nothing like as pervasive. They're just you could hardly find a 19th century person to whom the question of morality was not a very important question.
Well, what's replaced that in the way we live now? Is it machines? Is it money? Preoccupation with...
Well, they had those things too. I mean, you are well aware there were the people in the late 19th century in particular who were very anxious to make money and did make lots of money. That's when the Rockefeller fortune, the Carnegie fortune, the Mellon fortune was all created. So it certainly was not the case that our 19th century forebears were less materialistic than we are. You know, Wayne, it's such a complicated and interesting question. I think we should save it for a whole separate conversation sometime.
Professor Scott, what's the meaning of the term women's rights?
The meaning of the term women's rights? Well, it varies, of course, from time to time. In 1848, when the first declaration of sentiments from the Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls was published, a married woman was dead in the eyes of the law. She could not own property. If, for example, I had inherited $1 million from my grandfather, and you and I got married, the day after, the moment the marriage ceremony was complete, $1 million was yours to do with as you liked. Unless I had had the foresight, which very few women had, to draw up a premarital agreement in which you would agree that the money would remain in my hands. Furthermore, you could will all that property away from me, and I could do nothing about it, unless I might have had, for example, widow's rights, dower rights. But if it had been a large amount of property, you could have given 2/3 of it to anybody you liked.
Well, you're saying that women's rights amount to the almighty buck. Is that it?
No. I'm saying at different times it's different things. I said in 1848 that was a big issue, women's property rights. In 1848, no woman anywhere in this country could vote. I think what women are asking for now is the elimination of obstacles which prevent them from achieving, if they are prepared to achieve, in the professions and in business and in the whole area of our national life. I took the precaution of saying that I spend most of my time in the 19th century so that I wouldn't have to be very specific about the 20th century legal situation. In my own view, the Equal Rights Amendment is principally important as a statement of philosophy. And if it's in the Constitution, it could then serve as a kind of measuring stick for lots of other things.
So it's a question of both goals and means.
That's right. The goal is really rather simple, I think, which is that people should be free to achieve whatever they have the capacity to achieve.
Professor Scott, let me turn the conversation to your work here at the National Humanities Center. You've written about the spread of feminist values in the 19th century, with particular respect to a woman named Emma Willard. Who was Emma Willard?
Emma Willard was a woman born in the same year that the Constitution was created, who grew up with the desire, as she once said, or she said many times, to further the progress of my sex. And she chose to do this by initiating an educational institution which would make it possible for women to have much the same opportunity that was available to men at a time when women were not admitted to any college in the country. She said that she was going to found a seminary rather than a college in order not to scare the men. She called it a seminary. But in her secret heart, she wanted to give women every single educational opportunity that anybody had, including higher mathematics. She did this. She asked the New York State Legislature to provide public funds for such a purpose, and they said that was a fine idea, but they never voted the money. So she did it with private resources, including her own. She established a reputation for having the best school in the country, so soon people were coming from all over the country. And she had the vision of creating people who would go out and do likewise.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Professor Ann Firer Scott teaches history at Duke University. She is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Dr. Scott has written several books and numerous articles about women in the 19th century in America, including work on democracy and social ethics, women in the South, and women and politics, religion, and education. Professor Scott's discussion for Soundings focuses on Emma Willard, founder of the Troy Female Seminary in New York State, and on Willard's connections to the development of American feminism in the 19th and 20th centuries. Would you characterize her as a respectable academic in the eyes of her male colleagues? Or would they even acknowledge a woman as a colleague?
I doubt if they would have thought of her in those terms, but she herself said once or twice that she thought that her intellectual training was at least the equal of most college professors. She undertook some serious scientific research on her own. She published a book on the circulation of the blood, but her chief academic achievement was that she simply educated herself, since there was no college she could go to, in mathematics, in science, as it was in the early part of the 19th century, in literature, in philosophy. She taught a course in mental and moral philosophy to the seniors, which was very similar to the course that was taught at Harvard, Brown, Yale, Princeton, whatever.
You've characterized mm-hmm. Emma Willard as both a true woman, quote-unquote, that is to say, embodying the traditional notions of womanhood, and at the same time you've talked about her as a feminist. Now that sounds like this continuum process that you're describing.
And it also is a very good illustration of what I talked about earlier, which is that in order to accomplish what she did, she had to be careful not to alienate the community, and particularly the male community, because first of all, she tried to get help from the New York State Legislature. In fact, she tried over a period of years. She sought support from people like the former President Thomas Jefferson and the former President John Adams, and she didn't intend to shock any of those people with her radical behavior. She was beautifully dressed, she spoke beautifully. When she went out to make a speech, as she often did, she asked to have a chair so that she could sit, and then she could call it a conversation, since it wasn't really ladylike to stand on a platform and make a speech. That was something men did. So she just played this double game all the time, but she was constantly encouraging women to do the best they could do. And she thought there was nothing they couldn't learn if they'd really try.
Professor Scott, what kinds of courses, what kind of learning, what kind of training occurred for women at Troy?
Well, they were taught mathematics, and they were given every opportunity to move to the highest level of mathematics. They had the first, I think perhaps, they had the first laboratory courses in science in which the students performed experiments. Uh-huh. The habit in the male colleges at that time was for the professor to perform the experiment for the student to watch. But at Troy, Almira Lincoln, who was Emma Willard's younger sister, initiated laboratory courses where the students perform their own experiments.
Why would it be so important that women would take courses in mathematics and chemistry?
Because that proved that they were able to do anything men could do. It was a very important symbolic thing.
What about the social graces?
Oh yes, they were supposed to be well dressed. They were supposed to, Emma Willard believed in physical culture. She thought women should be healthy, and so she encouraged them to dance. She encouraged them to take a walk every day. She encouraged them to eat lightly and drink moderately of wine, or maybe not at all. And they were supposed to be, of course, a model woman in that respect, but a very intelligent model woman.
What, Professor Scott, has happened to Emma Willard's ideals?
Well, one could say that she prepared the groundwork for several things. She said one time that the whole measure of her life would be in what her pupils did in their lives. And my research has focused on 3,500 of those pupils, for whom I have a little bit of biographical information about each one. And they did become the leaders in their communities in many cases. They became the women who were looked up to, who formed the literary societies, who formed in the leadership, truly, of the female subculture, if you want to call it that.
Professor Scott, what kinds of achievements did these women go on
to? There's a small group who became professionals. There were a few doctors, quite a few missionaries, including at least one medical missionary. there were a handful of women who didn't become lawyers, because that was very difficult, but who became legal assistants to their husbands. They read law and did law clerks kind of work. The majority of the women who worked for pay were teachers. And a great many of those, probably 200 of those, founded schools. So their major achievement was in multiplying the effect of Troy by founding schools in other parts of the country. Then there's a whole group, of course, who never worked in any career sense, but who were wives and mothers and leaders in the voluntary associations.
Professor Scott, you've written about voluntary associations, which you've just mentioned. Could you describe those briefly?
The voluntary association, that is, groups of people getting together without any relationship to the authorities, things which in Europe would have been done by the government, in this country, in the colonial period, were done by citizens getting themselves together. If you've read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, you remember how he and his friends got together and each one threw in a few shillings and they founded a library. He and his friends got together and founded a volunteer fire department and had such a good time that soon there were a dozen other volunteer fire departments in Philadelphia. By the time Tocqueville came here in the 1830s, the thing that he noticed most about Americans was what he called this tendency to associate, get themselves together to do what had to be done, take the initiative. Now, this subject has, this social phenomenon has been so important in the forming of American society, and yet it has not been studied very much. But if voluntary associations themselves as a whole have been neglected, the question of women's voluntary associations has been almost untouched until maybe the last 6 or 7 years. And what is now becoming more and more clear to me and to other people, I think, is that women in the 19th century, cut off from the professions, cut off from the government. They couldn't do these things. They couldn't become doctors and lawyers without enormous effort. They couldn't vote. They couldn't run for office. They couldn't become governors and presidents. Executed an end run around all those obstacles by forming their own societies and then taking stands and doing things that shaped the social behavior.
Well, that's essentially what Mrs. Willard did with Troy, is it not?
It's what she did with Troy, and it's what hundreds and hundreds and thousands of other women did in an almost incredible variety of kinds of associations. For example, we're all familiar with missionary societies and benevolent societies and charitable societies. But did you realize, for example, that in the Middle West, over and over and over again, the initiation of the public library came through a ladies' library society? Or have you ever wondered how we got kindergartens in this country? There were kindergarten associations in every town, practically. I found some interesting just individual little clubs for a particular purpose. Here in North Carolina, women, for example, to jump ahead a little bit, in the first decade of the 20th century formed clubs with the main focus of cleaning up the milk supply. Babies were getting sick and dying because of dirty milk. And it was women's organizations who finally got the rules and regulations, the requirement of pasteurization and of cleaning and all this sort of thing, which we now take for granted. You don't ever expect to pick up a bottle of milk in the grocery store that's going to make your baby sick. But it happened all the time. There's just a dense web of women's organizations through the whole time since 1800, doing every imaginable kind of thing in the way of trying to shape the communities in which they live.
Not the least of which was education.
I can think offhand of at least three of the major women's colleges which were in effect begun as a result of the efforts of a ladies' education society. Radcliffe College is the first. What is the women's college of Brown University? Pembroke. A ladies' education society of Providence, Rhode Island was established for the purpose of providing women with the same opportunity that young men had at Brown. And it was their work which created Pembroke College. A ladies' society of the Methodist Church in Baltimore decided that our daughters should have opportunities equal to those of our sons. And thus we have Goucher College. On and on and on. You see, the voluntary association is an institution-building phenomenon.
Professor Scott, is there a figure, or are there figures on the American scene today that embody the spirit of Emma Willard, to come back to one of the points of our discussion?
Well, I'm sure we have our modern versions of Emma Willard in the sense that there are people who now identify needs. She identified a need for education that was pervasive and which was not being met. At the time that she first went to work, she formed her first school in Middlebury, Vermont in 1814. And at that time, there was perhaps three or four places in the whole country where a young woman could get anything approaching an academic education. So she identified a need. She set out to accomplish, with her own labor, the meeting of that need. She inspired thousands of women by her behavior because they could see what she had done. And one thing I've discovered in studying the biographies of her pupils is over and over and over again, in old age, they were saying, well, I hope Mrs. Willard will be satisfied with what I've done with my life. Now, what would be a contemporary analog? What are the great needs that women face today? I think that would be the question I would ask, and then I would go looking for the people who are filling those needs. I think that one might suggest that instead of one or two or half a dozen giant figures now, what we would be more likely to find would be thousands of women working in particular communities on particular problems and trying to meet felt needs. But it would certainly be, they would be in the spirit of Emma Willard, because they're identifying a need and trying by their own labor to meet that need.
Professor Scott, the response to what you've been describing from the cynic perhaps would be, so what? Why is it necessary to look at the history of the women's movement as it moves from people like Emma Willard up to 1981?
I suppose that any historian is always sensitive to the charge that you should be paying attention to contemporary problems, with things like the deterioration of the environment and the shortage of energy and the political crisis that faces us and the danger that inflation will wipe out our society. Why do you take time to live in the 19th century? It's a good question, and I suppose it's one that we are constantly asking ourselves. I suppose one part of the answer would be that the more I work on the women that I've been telling you about, the more I feel a responsibility to do something about my own society in my private life. So that last night, for example, I spent a very great deal of time at the Board of Aldermen performing my civic duty. But I think a better answer might be that if you don't know where you've come from, it's more difficult to know where you're going. And I think that for the women in our society today, it's my experience at any rate that whenever I go out talking about these things to groups who are made up of activist women, they are uniformly interested and invigorated to find out that there have been roots to what they're doing. It makes a difference.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, inviting you to join us this week for the Center's radio program, Soundings. This week, Soundings investigates women in education in America in the 19th and 20th centuries. Join us for a conversation with Professor Ann Scott of Duke University. I hope you'll listen for Soundings.